My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you and conferences like this and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th of 1973, and for that I'm eternally grateful. I want to thank Lane and Connie and the committee and all of the wonderful people that have been in touch with Sally and myself and have given us a marvelous weekend. We're very privileged and honored to be a part of your fourth annual conference. He did call me Jack a couple of times. I'm not really sure who I am. Just to get started, and Lane came up and said I look like an attorney, and that kind of crushed my ego. I was listening to Jack the other night, and I think he introduced his sobriety as September the 17th, 1946, and it occurred to me that he had 11 months of sobriety before you had AA and Brian and College Station. And, I'm always privileged and awed to be in the presence of, I guess, quote, what you call the old-timer, because I suspect that carrying the banner and the privilege of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1946 and the late 40s and the early 50s is not as it is today. And I'm very grateful to have somebody with the program carved in their life that I can touch and see and feel and be with. So I feel very privileged. We've had a lot of talk about, love messages this weekend, and I agree with Beth, this probably is the greatest love story, at least in my life, and I'm reminded of the little Indian boy that fell in love with the little Indian girl out in the great white plains of New Mexico, and because of logistics, they couldn't see each other very much, and so every day the little Indian boy would build a fire, and he would send up his smoke signals and his love message, and the little Indian girl would build her fire, and she would send up her love message, and unbeknownst to him, they were testing the atom bomb somewhere in the distance. And just as he was building his fire one morning, this bomb went off, and they released this. And he saw this big pillar of smoke and this mushroom and all these clouds go to the top of the sky. And he raised up and he said, "Wow," he said, "I wish I could write letters like that." And the interesting thing about it is, for all the smoke that was there, that had no meaning for the little Indian girl. The thing that touched her heart the most was the fact that he was sending up a message that, was meaningful to her. And so I think if you're alcoholic this morning, or if you're Al-Anon or Alateen, each of you in this room has a message, and you each have a story to tell. And, I think each of you have a life to save. I think God gifted each one of us with the ability to touch one other human being that nobody else can touch. And I think basically we're all here this morning because one other human being had the ability to reach in and touch you deeper than all the rest. And maybe many of us are here this morning, in sobriety because one other person along the way had the ability to reach in and touch you. And I'm fascinated because we've talked a great deal about recovery and sometimes the slowness of recovery. But the miracle of sobriety happened instantly. One day I was a drunk and the next day I'm sober. And if you have a sobriety date in this room, that's a miracle unto itself. Those of you that drank for 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years and one day you were drunk and the next day you're sober, the miracle of that still blows me away. And I had no idea of knowing that on September the 6th of 1973, that I would be drinking my last drink, and on September the 7th of 1973, I was sober. And I think for everybody in this room that has a sobriety date, one day you were drunk and the next day you were sober. I've loved hearing and being with all of the speakers this weekend. I could relate so much to Beth when she talked about that approval, just the absolute necessity of being a part of. And I think that was true for me, that I was addicted to approval a long time before I was ever addicted to alcohol. I think people talked to me about my attitude. People talked to me about my behavior long before they ever talked to me about my alcoholism or my drinking. I thought for the longest time that money was my problem and other things were my problem. My creditors never called up and said, "Hey, you're drinking too much." I don't know about your, my creditors called and said, would you please make a payment? And for the longest time, I thought money, you know, was really my problem. And I think when you're addicted to approval, you're very easy to manipulate. I think you do things that you don't want to do with people that you don't want to be with and places that you don't want to go. And all of a sudden you become a second-class citizen doing second-class things in second-class places that you really don't like. And I think that's the thing that I love about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it permits me to be a first-class citizen in first-class places doing first-class things. And I was never able to do that until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised by a marvelous father, a fun-loving man who had a fourth-grade education, came from a large farm down in Virginia. And I remember my father's philosophy being, if it isn't fun, chances are I won't be doing it for more than a week. And yeah, I love that. And being an only child and an only son, my father took me everywhere. And he loved to hunt, and he loved to fish, and he loved to live off the land. And I remember I was born and raised up in Iowa. There's a lady here somewhere that is from Newton, Iowa, my hometown. I told her it was the birthplace of a famous American, and she wasn't too awed by that. But I remember I used to hunt. They'll go duck hunting with my father in the early morning, and I used to get so cold in that duck blind. And part of my father's standard equipment was a half pint of old Guggenheimer. And I remember one morning in this duck blind, my father saying, take a little sip of this and you'll feel better. And I remember that it really did. You know, I just kind of had a little sip of it, and it went down, and I could feel the effects of it, and I felt better. And on the other hand, I was raised by a mother that cured all the illnesses of the world with a Vicks jar and a piece of flannel. Now, my mother is still alive and well at 82 today in California, and if you were to go to the medicine cabinet, you would still find the Vicks jar in there. And it didn't make any difference what the illness was. Mom just started with the Vicks jar about here and worked her way down. But the thing that I loved the most was she could make a hot toddy that was second to none. And just before I would go to bed, Mother would take the warm water, the hot lemon water and the sugar and a couple fingers of three feathers or four roses or Old Crow or whatever it was, and she would mix that all together and she'd say, take a little sip of this and you'll feel better. And just before bedtime, you know, I'd take a little sip of that hot toddy and I'd kind of perspire a little bit and then I'd go to sleep and I always felt better. And for the most part, that's what the alcohol did for me. It always made me feel a little better. And when reality got so painful that I couldn't handle it anymore, I could always drink and feel better, and I could always alter the situation. So I've loved alcohol from the beginning. I drank in high school and in the service, and I was in the one that Archie Bunker calls the big one, the WW2. That was my war. And I remember I had completed basic training in Chicago and Great Lakes, and I had been shipped to a disembarkation base in California called Camp Shoemaker. There were about 95,000 other sailors there. And one weekend, the first weekend liberty that we had, two other fellows and myself were just going to hitchhike over to a small town and have a few drinks on Friday night and Saturday night, and then we would hitchhike back to the base on Sunday, and it would just be a fun weekend. And I remember that the party started on Friday night, and then we drank Saturday, and then I don't remember much until I got back to the base on Tuesday. Now, people get very upset about that in the military. And I remember they came to the barracks, and they asked me to get in this jeep, and I'm standing in front of the provost marshal, and I'm being served a captain's mess. Now, the thing about the alcoholism that has always deceived me is that the scars of alcoholism never show. The scar tissue is never on the outside, but I started collecting alcoholic scar tissue when I was very small. You know, it comes in the form of insecurity or inadequacy. I listened to Marie last night talk about the desolation and the loneliness. You know, and it shows up in the forms of insufficient funds or AWOL or driving while intoxicated or captain's mess or dishonorable discharge. But, you know, I have no scars to see that. When I get up in the morning and I kind of look in the mirror, I say, I don't see any scars. I must have overreacted. And so, you know, the scar tissues of alcoholism are very deceptive and they don't show, but they're there from a very early age. I got out of the service and went back to the University of Iowa in the fall of 1946, and in January of 1947, I wandered into a small Iowa tavern. I loved it. Last night, Steve back there, a good friend of ours, took Sally and I down for some ice cream, and we went down to the campus, and we had a chance to walk along all the taverns down there, and they were just full. And Sally and I kind of laughed and giggled because that's where we first met. I saw her in a small Iowa tavern, and I remember seeing her for the first time, like I'm looking at her right now, and I thought she was absolutely the most beautiful lady I had ever seen, the most striking woman that had just touched my heart. And I remember in true alcoholic fashion, I just said, that should be mine. And I basically had one problem. I was engaged to another girl at the time. And that's never been a problem for alcoholics. I mean, we decide to go from there to there, we just go. I mean, we don't tell anybody. But the deceptiveness of my disease was already at work because, you know, last night I listened to Marie talk about that inward uncleanliness and the insecurity. And what I really thought in my own mind is if I could capture the queen and put her under glass, that would make me a king. Somehow I thought if I could do good things, you would think I was good. I always wanted to be nice. And I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that if you want to be a nice person, you have to be a nice person. I mean, it's not any more complicated than that. And I want to tell you, in true alcoholic fashion, I somehow got Sally's telephone number, and I called her, and I explained to her that I thought it would be a marvelous thing if the two of us got together. Now, Sally had known the girl that I was engaged to. If you were here to listen to Sally the other night, the girl that I was engaged to was talking to Sally about my drinking. So, I mean, Sally knew full well what I was and the kind of a problem that I was to her. Yet somehow when you talk to alcoholics, you're in trouble. Because we are cunning and we're baffling and we're powerful and we're slick and we're the greatest salesman in the world. Somehow I convinced Sally that we should go out together. 3 weeks later, I cashed in all of my war bonds, got drunk, bought a ring big enough to go over any finger, called Sally at the dorm and said, "Would you meet me outside at 10:30? And I remember being so drunk I could hardly get the car parked. It was on this parallel ledge. And I remember just kind of rolling the car over there, and Sally came out, got in the front seat of the car. I put the ring on the wrong finger and said, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life?" And you know, as of last June the 19th, Sally and I have been married for 39 years. That is a very strong lady. Sally, would you stand up for a second? Forgetting, I was saying, I guess it was to Lane yesterday, I said, somehow alcoholics find women with steel backs because we break anybody else in half. I'm just fascinated how in the world we do that. Sally and I were married, and we were two young, frightened kids, and that addiction that I had as an individual became an addiction as a couple, and Sally and I wanted so desperately to be accepted by society, and we wanted to be loved by you. And I remember our parents helped us buy our first GI house, and on the weekends, we would drive around neighborhoods that we couldn't afford, and we'd look at your houses. And I remember one time we drove by this house that had this red door and this brass kick plate. And we thought, wouldn't that be wonderful? And we went home and painted our door red and put up this brass kick plate. And then a couple weeks later, we would drive around another hood, and we'd look at your shutters. And then we'd go home and put shutters on our place. And then in a little while, we'd go look at your shrubbery, and then we would go get shrubbery and put it in front of our place because we knew sooner or later, you would drive by our house, you would nudge each other and say, "Damn, that's a good-looking house." And it should be because it looked just like yours. But the trap that we fell into with the insidious part of the disease of alcoholism, and Beth and Marie both talked about this, is we tried to get so clean on the inside, or on the outside, that we would feel good on the inside. Or we would look so good on the outside that you would think we were okay on the inside. And we never were. We never saw the disease of alcoholism. You know, you're dealing with a disease powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. And if you cripple your children with the disease of alcoholism in the home, then you can't be too startled when they limp in society and have a tough time. We have four children. We have a daughter, Roxanne, who's going to be 38, and and a guy 34, and one 32, and one 29, and four grandchildren, and I hope I will talk about the recovery of the children before this hour gets away from me. I've always been in sales, and Sally and I have moved around a great deal, and I was working for a large corporation called Owens Corning Fiberglass, and I had just received a large promotion to go to New York, and I don't know about you, but every time we had an opportunity to move, at least for Sally and myself, we would always go through this thing of, God, we've got a chance to start over again. I don't remember that Sally and I ever sat down in the quietness of our house and said, is this going to be a good move for us? Will this hurt any of the four children? Is there somebody that's going to have to move up a grade or back a grade? I mean, we didn't have that luxury in our alcoholic home. What we had was an opportunity to start over again. And I remember Sally and myself and the four children got in the car and we drove to New York, and I went to my office, and Sally took the children and went up to Connecticut, and she found a beautiful home, an old home that was built in 1812 by a sea captain, just a magnificent thing, a romantic place for our family. And if you had stopped me on the streets of New York and had said to me, Albert, how are things going in your life? I would have said, fantastic. And I really believed that because I did all of the things that society had asked of me, and it should have added up. And I couldn't figure out why I was bleeding to death on the inside. I would look you in the eye and say, I have this beautiful wife and this marvelous job and these four kids and this dog and this house, and it's just perfect. And on the inside, I was bleeding to death. I remember one time I came home drunk on a Friday night from New York, and as I came through the back door, Sally made some comment about my condition. And whenever she would do that and I would know that she was right, I would go into my alcoholic defense mechanism. I loved sarcasm, just one-line sarcasm. That was my defense mechanism, just anything that would tear the flesh and back you up 2 or 3 feet. And when Sally would start in on me, I would just let her have it. And then invariably she would always react the same way, and she would say to me, do you mean that? And I would say, do I mean what? What you just said. What did I just say? Well, you know what you said. No, I don't. Tell me what you think you thought you heard. And then she would tell me. And then I would say to her, oh, God, you took that all wrong. I did not say it like that. I did not use that tone of voice. And if I could get her to talk long enough, invariably she would say, God, I'm sorry for misunderstanding. Now, the insanity of that is we didn't do that once in a while. We did that week after week, month after month, year after year, because we never saw the disease of alcoholism. I had been traveling in Texas for several weeks, and I had flown back to New York and leased a car, and I was drunk. And once again, I arrived on a Friday night. I used to think, oh, here's Mr. Wonderful again. I don't know why I thought that, but it just if I could get the body home, I thought somebody would love me for that. And as I came through the door that night, I remember Sally looking at me and saying, I just can't do this anymore. I would rather be dead than live with you the way we are. And somehow I knew there was something in her voice that was different that time. And I quietly said, hey, babe, why don't you get some sleep? It's been a tough week. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk about it and look better. And I want to tell you, on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, the only lady that I've ever really loved said to me, I would rather be dead than live with you. And she took a razor blade that was sitting on top of our dresser, and I remember she scurried to the master bathroom with the intent of slashing her wrists, and I began to yell and say, my God, Sally, don't do that. If my drinking bothers you that much, I won't drink it. Please don't kill yourself. Now I want to tell you, those four beautiful children that I just talked about a few minutes ago are standing right behind me while I'm screaming, don't kill yourself, to their mother. And I've been privileged to work and sponsor in part some of the Alateens in this program, and they've taught me a great deal about the disease of alcoholism. I was working with a 15-year-old boy that was getting beat up pretty regularly, and one night Jack got in my car, and I said, Jack, how are things going? And he said, Mr. Myers, they sound pretty good. And I said, what do you mean they sound pretty good? He said, well, they sound pretty good. He said, the disease of alcoholism has a sound to it, and that's how I defend myself. He said, Mr. Myers, I can put one foot in the house and determine the condition of the home immediately by the sound. There's either too much noise or there's no noise at all, or there's yelling or sarcasm or profanity or flesh hitting flesh or furniture hitting furniture. Several months ago, Sally and I were privileged to listen to an Alla teen called Sissy in Mobile, Alabama, that talked about the deadly silence because her mom was a kitchen drunk. And when she heard the wrong silence, it was deadly. She would react. And Jack said to me, that's how I defend myself. When I hear the wrong sound, I either go to my room, turn off the lights, turn up the stereo, and try to get lost. Or I call a friend that I think will understand, and we try to talk. Or if the pain just gets too great, I go back out on the street because there's less pain on the street than there is in the home. And he said to me, you know, Mr. Myers, if the sound of your house is the same today as it was a year ago, chances are you're not growing. I've had Alla teen say to me, you know, my dad was profane when he was drinking. He's 2 years in the program and he's still profane. When's he going to grow? And I have to say, I don't know. And Sally and I started to take an inventory of the sounds in our marriage and in our relationship that were causing us pain and problems. And some of them are very innocent. I'm talking in sobriety now. On a Friday night in sobriety, I would come home to Sally and I would say, how would you like to go out for dinner? And she'd say, terrific. And we would get in the car and start down the street, and I would say to her, where would you like to go for dinner? And she would say to me, I don't care. And I'd say, let's go over to Vincent's and get some seafood. She says, I don't feel like seafood tonight. I said, let's go over to the Split Rail and get some barbecue. She says, I don't feel like barbecue tonight. Now, we alcoholics are very sensitive. And we don't take rejection well. And I would say it was just a matter of minutes before Sally and I would say, well, God damn it, then let's just go home, and the fight would start. And in sobriety, we had to go through and take out all of the painful things in our marriage and our relationship from the sounds. You know, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. My having a good love affair with Sally has very little to do with Sally. It has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. When my behavior is funny, my love affair is funny. And that holds true with the relationships with my friends or my job or my work. The only time that my work goes bad is when I'm not working bad, when I'm not working right. And that's the thing that brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was finally I couldn't sell myself on my own behavior and I had to do something about it. I got my arms around Sally that morning. We took her to a psychiatrist. We always took her to a psychiatrist. Took her to five psychiatrists. And somehow we thought, I don't know how we thought if we could get her fixed, I wouldn't drink so much. And I don't know how we did that, but we finally went to the psychiatrist and we said we would do whatever he told us to do. And I remember we wrote this down on paper one day, just like you'd sketch the blueprints of a house. And he said, you're Iowa farm kids, and you're out of your element, and you're back here in New England, and you don't commute well, and you don't travel well. And if you go back to Iowa and be surrounded by your family and some monetary stability and a few other things, and you don't travel, you'll be okay. And we wrote all that down. And we never wrote down the disease of alcoholism because we didn't see it. Sally never called me an alcoholic. I just drank too much sometimes. And we made our ninth move back to Iowa. This time it was going to be different. And we bought the right house in the right part of the town and close to the church and close to the school and a large enough yard and all the bedrooms, and it should have been perfect. And somehow I continued to drink and I became a periodic drunk. Used to be a fellow by the name of Bob White down at Whitney that said, if you go on those periodic drunks often enough, they will show up in your living room. And I'm going to call them they because I don't know where they come from, and they show up when you need them the least. And I had been on this four-day drunk, and when I got back, they were in my living room. And they were saying, you need to go to the alcohol and psychiatric clinic at the University of Iowa. And when alcoholics finally get cornered and the evidence becomes so tangible that you can't wiggle anymore, you begin to say funny things like, okay. There wasn't any place left to go. And so on a Monday morning, I'm at the alcohol and psychiatric clinic at the University of Iowa, and a man that I had known socially was talking to me about my drinking. And he said, "Albert, when you drink anymore, you hurt people." And I said, "Yes, I don't mean to, John, but I know that." And he said, "When you drink anymore, you get in all kinds of trouble." And I said, "I know that too." And he said, "Let me tell you something about alcohol." He said, "There are people that are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. Your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain." And I remember saying to John, "God, John, I'm allergic to alcohol." He said, "That's right. And you need to talk to somebody from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you need to go to an AA meeting." And on a Friday afternoon, a gentleman by the name of Gil Voss, who is now dead, took 3.5 hours of a busy afternoon that he didn't have to work with me and do exactly what it tells you to do in this big book, working with others. And he told me about all of the guilt and the shame and the degradation and the DWIs and the bankruptcies and the separations and the divorces and on and on and on. And every time he would say that, up here, I did what Beth did. That hasn't happened to me yet. I must not be alcoholic. That hasn't happened to me yet. And I remember I went home that afternoon and I told Sally, I said, "My God, you should have heard that story." I said, "It was terrible. If I get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. Or if I get as bad as your father, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous." Now I want to tell you, Sally and I knew about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because her father came in 1952. We've been around the program since 1952. We saw what it could do for him and for her family and for their structure. As a matter of fact, when I finally made it in 1973, I said to Dad, I said, "My God, Dad, why didn't you talk to me about my drinking? I mean, I took all the things that you truly loved in this life. I took your daughter, and I took your love, and I took your money, and I took everything that I could take from you, and you never once talked to me about my drinking." And this marvelous man with these just soft, piercing blue eyes looked me right in the eye and he said, "You would have resented it so much coming from me that it would have ruined the opportunity for the right person to reach you." He said, "God made us all different, so we need each other. If he made us all the same, one of us wouldn't be necessary." And I will be forever grateful to the man for treating me like that. I continued to drink, and they showed up again, and they said, "We're going to take your house, and we're going to sell it, and we're going to keep the equity." And I was saying funny things like, "Okay." And they said, "We'll give you some basic furniture to live with, but we're going to auction off the furniture, and we're going to keep the equity." And I remember Sally and myself, just as it happened yesterday, that Sally and myself and the four kids, and we're standing on the lawn. The house has been sold and the furniture is being auctioned off, and we never saw the disease of alcoholism. We just never saw it. I remember the kids got to be 18 and they'd go off to college, and I would think, isn't that wonderful? Hell, they never came back. The first opportunity they had to get out of the alcoholic home, they left. I remember my daughter wrote me a letter one time, and in there was a little passage that said, "You'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same." And I remember having read that over and over again, thinking, "My heavens, what have I done to destroy the relationship that means so much to me? I mean, I'm motivated by my good intentions, but you keep judging me on my actions." And I want to scream out and say, "Can't you see my intentions are good? Because I don't want to be the way I am." And the oldest son hit the campus in the late 60s and got into some trouble and sold and jailed and trafficked for drugs and married and divorced with child before he was 19, and a child with another relationship with no marriage. And I remember Sally and I used to sit and look at each other and wonder, what in the world is going on? We didn't teach them that values. What's wrong with us? What's wrong with us? And the middle son, it seemed to me one morning I came to breakfast and Tom was gone. And John couldn't get away. He was just too young. He couldn't buy his way out, and age wouldn't do anything for him. So in 1972, I used a friend, and Sally and myself and one son moved to Shreveport, Louisiana. And if you were here to hear Sally talk about it Friday, I just drank around the clock. It was just a matter of trying to exist from one day to the next. I would get up and try to figure out how to get through the day. And one night in a place called Shreve Square, I was driving down the street, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and these red lights were going around, and I thought, uh-oh. And I've heard about Louisiana Caddo Parish police deputies, and they're mean, and I'll try to be careful, and I'll be prepared and ready when they get me pulled over. And I remember once again trying to get the car just parallel parked here and next to the curb, and sure enough, these two Caddo Parish police deputies came around to the side of the car, and I rolled down the window, and they said, "Could we have your driver's license?" And I said, "Sure." And I just handed it to them out the window, and then I made a grave tactical error. I rolled up the window, drove off, and left them standing there. Their reputation is well-founded. And the second time they got the car stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. They just pulled me from the car and threw me over the hood. And I remember the handcuffs going up the back, and I'm thinking, "God, I hope nobody's watching this." You know, and I'm laid out there. And they finally get me down to the jail cell on Texas Avenue and do all the things that they need to do when they're booking you for driving while intoxicated. And I'm kind of waving to the guys and the girls, "You're having a good time." And finally, the guy says, "We got to put you in a cell." I said, "Terrific. You know, what do I care?" And for some reason, as the man shoved me in the cell, I remember going in there head first, and as I turned around, the bars were coming together, and then that sound that God created for us when that comes together. And for one second, I can't tell you why, I saw myself in the glass building in New York overlooking Central Park to the jail cell in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I thought, "Damn, there's something wrong." And the man said, "You can make a call," and that scared me to death because I didn't have anybody to call. People that had loved me for so long were just worn out and said, "Don't call. We don't care." And I remember I called a customer, and Frank's not in the program, but Frank came down and got me out of jail. That's what drunks do, when, you know, when they're salesmen, they call their customers. And Frank came down and got me out of jail. I remember we got in the front seat of the car, and I said to Frank, "Let's go get a six-pack and straighten this out." He said, "No." No, I said, "Albert, I tell you what, why don't you come to my house, and in the morning we'll try to figure out what to do." God, try to figure out what to do with me. It was such a degrading sound, and I thought, "I don't want to be the way I am. What's wrong with me?" And I remember I didn't sleep that night, and he had a big kitchen clock, and I watched that clock until it got to be exactly 6 o'clock, and I called an Episcopal priest, and I said, "Father Paul, this is Albert, and I am in big trouble." And he said, "Can you get down to the church?" And I said, "I think so." And we got down there, and he talked to me for a little while, and he said, "Albert, I'd like for you to go to this halfway house." He said, "It's called the Bridge House on Stoner Avenue." And he said, "There's a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor down there that I think you can relate to." And I thought, "God, who is he talking to? I'm kind of a high-class guy. I mean, I've had an executive job in New York, and this guy's talking about halfway houses and a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor that I can relate to." But, you know, pretty soon you say funny things like, "Okay." And on a Friday morning at exactly 10:30, I went to the Bridge House, and there was a fellow there by the name of Bill Smith, who's also dead now. And he was a marvelous man. And they sat me down at the end of the table, about where they had me at the end, and these three old railroad guys and Bill were there. And one of them said to me, "When did you have your last drink?" And God, I started to cry, and this just volcanic emotion started to come to the top. And I'm pounding the table, and I said, "I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks, and I got this DWI, and the house is gone, and the furniture's gone, and three of the four kids are gone, and Sally wants to leave, and I'm about to get fired, and they want to pick up the car." And one of those old turkeys turned to the other one and said, "Boy, he sure sounds like one of us." And one of them said to me, "Would you do anything to get sober?" I said, "I'll do anything. I'll do anything." And one of them said to me, "Would you go to 7 meetings in a row?" God, 7 meetings in a row. Gee. You know, I looked over my shoulder, and there they were, "Live and Let Live, Easy Does It." And I'd seen those. Those had been in Sally's dad's house, and I said, "Hey, these guys are talking about Alcoholics Anonymous." And I started to back up, and this marvelous old man put his arm around my shoulder, and I can still feel his touch. And he said, Albert, we need to go for a ride. I need to go over to Shumpert Hospital and visit a friend in the alcoholic ward. And I want you to talk to Sister Germaine. And somehow the tone of his voice said, it's going to be okay. I mean, I wanted to scream, but you don't understand, I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks. And somehow he said, it'll be all right. Yeah, but God, I can't stay out of jail. It'll be okay. Yeah, but God, I got this skid row of the soul. I understand. And no matter what I said that morning, Bill said, it'll be all right. And somehow I knew he knew. And we got in his car and we started towards the hospital. And Bill said to me, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. And that's all he said. And I started thinking about that. I, damn, you know, the priest is right. I can relate to this guy. I mean, I don't know how he's doing that, but I love the cure. And we went over to the hospital, and we talked to his friend for a while. And on the way back, Bill set the hook one more time. And he said, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. Matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow. I said, Bill, how long have you been doing that? He said, what's that, Albert? I said, that not quit drinking. He said, 27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow. But he said, Albert, you need to know nobody ever took my right to drink away from me. I don't know what I thought you were going to take away from me. You know, we alcoholics have a hold of this rock, and we're going to the bottom of the lake, and everybody around us is saying, let go of the rock. And we're saying, hell no. I said, Bill, you're going to take away my freedom. And God, this pathetic glaze just came over his face, and he said, your freedom? He said, let's talk a little bit about freedom. He said, you know, I have this dog that I put out in the backyard every day, and it just barks at the birds and rolls up the sunshine, and it's got plenty to eat and drink, and at night I come home and pick it up, and I take it in the house and love it. And I said, I could let that dog be perfectly free and open up the back gate. And it could get run over by a truck or go without food and starve or picked up by somebody that doesn't love it as much as I do. He said, it seems to me of the two freedoms, I'd rather be the dog on the inside of the fence. He said, you can be as big and as free as you want as long as you stay on the inside of the fence and the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I said, Bill, I'm a salesman. And I got to go back out there and earn a living. And they're still out there, Bill, and somebody's going to ask me to have a drink, and I won't know what to tell them. He said, you want to know what to tell him? He said, why don't you try the truth? You haven't tried that in a long time. And I said to Bill, Bill, I don't understand that answer. He said, I know you don't, Albert. It's been so long since you've dealt in the areas of honesty. You don't know what that is anymore. He said, you want to know what to tell people if they ask you to have a drink? I said, God, yes. He said, tell them you can't drink that stuff. It gets you drunk. I said, is that it? He said, that's it. He said, you do understand when they drink it, it gets them drunk. I said, I never really thought about it. Now, I want to tell you, up here, I thought that will never work. I'm a little over 90 days in the program. Sally and I have moved to Dallas. I have a new job. An ex-Dallas Cowboy football player came to my office to sell me some radio media in the off-season. Dave said to me, let's go have lunch. We went to a place called The Hungry Hunter. And we went right up to the bar, and Dave said to me, Albert, would you like to have a drink? I said, oh, God, Dave, can't drink that stuff. It gets me drunk. He said, oh, geez, don't drink it. I said, okay, I won't. I think it's Elsa C. from Laguna Beach, that says we wouldn't worry nearly so much about what people thought about us if we realized how little they didn't. You know. My sponsor said to me, you need to get a sponsor that you can relate to every day. And I said, Bill, won't you be my sponsor? He said, yes, but you need a sponsor that you can talk to every day. He said, there's a fellow by the name of Hoss Ross that travels for RCA and he stays sober. Did you ever notice who we turn our life over to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? On a Thursday night at the Fairfield Group in Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm looking for a fellow by the name of Hoss Ross. And I said to a couple of guys, when Hoss shows up, let me know. Now, Hoss was about 6'4", weighed 135 pounds, and dressed in one color, all brown, all blue, all green. And he came through the side door at the Fairfield Club, and they said, that's Hoss. And I went over, and I said, you Hoss Ross? He said, that's right, son. I said, they tell me that you would be a good sponsor for me. Would you be my sponsor? He said, I'd be honored. So he said, you have one of them big books? I said, not of my own. He said, well, let's go get one. And I remember Hoss wrote in the front of my big book, To a Long Life in the Fellowship, Hoss Ross. And we signed a card that night at the Highland Club, and I became a member, and I became a part of. And I want to tell you, Hoss called me every single day. He'd say, what are you doing, son? I'd say, nothing. He'd say, I'll be right over. I want to tell you, after about 2 weeks, I told Sally, I said, hey, I've made a mistake here. Hoss called one night, and he said, what are you doing, son? I said, I'm busy tonight, Hoss. He said, good, I'll do it with you. Didn't make any difference. And he said, you'll be at that halfway house at 10:30 every morning, and we're going to start working the steps. And I want to tell you, he shared his life with me and his program with me. And on December the 13th of 1973, Sally and myself and one son drove to Dallas, Texas, and we didn't know a soul. And I was driving a car that was co-signed by my sponsor. And I was going to a job that was arranged by my sponsor. And the money that I had in my pocket to buy groceries was given to me by my sponsor. Because a person that didn't know me, had never met me, trusted me enough with the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will be forever grateful for sponsorship and people like Jack in this program. I listened to Marie talk last night in her ninth year. I want to tell you something. In my 12th year, I did some of my best alcoholic thinking. Sobriety has not altered my thinking all that much. I'm still competitive. I'm still tenacious. I'm still impulsive. Sally hates to send me to the grocery store for a quart of milk. Not too long ago, I came back. She said, how much was the milk? I said, $30. Somehow, I can't get those empty carts up and down the aisles without putting stuff in there. And you don't understand. Pant hangers and super glue and light bulbs are very important to me. And it isn't that I need them, but I'm going to need them. And I want to tell you, I was doing some funny thinking in sobriety. And I looked at business things that I thought were good and they weren't. And people around me that loved me said, hey, I don't think it's that good, Albert. And up here I said, man, if you knew how wonderful I am and how good that is, you wouldn't say that to me. You know, when AA comes of age, I think it's Dr. Tebow that says, regardless of our veteran status in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, at any time the disease of alcoholism can return, and normally it's in the form of halitosis. I got hooked up with some personalities in AA that just weren't compatible with mine, and people that loved me said, hey, I don't think that's all that good for you. And once again, I thought, how wonderful I am. And finally, I was going crazy, and I was thinking crazy, and I had reason to be up in Prince Albert. Sally and I were up in Prince Albert visiting, and I was talking to Cease, and many of you know Cease, and I said, Cease, I'm going crazy in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in sobriety. And he said, talk to me for a while about that, Albert. And we talked, and after a little while, Cease finally said to me, he said, Albert, it isn't that you're doing anything wrong. It's that you're not doing some things at all. And I said, Cease, what the hell does that mean? He said, well, when we come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous all beat up, we're very serious about the program, and we're not very serious about the personality. And in time, we start to get serious about the personality, and we're not as serious about the program. He said to me, sometimes we get so busy picking up the pieces that we drop the program. He said, I'll bet you don't read your 24-hour book every day anymore. He said, I'll bet you don't read pages 86 and 87 anymore. Bet you don't pray the way you used to. Eat the way you used to. I'll even bet you don't support your home group the way you used to. And I want to tell you, he just went down and kept nicking my heart. And in the 12th year of sobriety, I went back to the basics of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that you taught me, because if you don't protect the thing that's protecting you, you can get in big trouble. And that's why I love the Cease and the Jack, and there's a gentleman in here with 20 years. I love your sobriety, those of you that carried the banner in front of me. The daughter called one day and said, hey,
I'm having problems in my relationship. Can I come to Texas with one of the grandsons? And I said, sure, honey, when are you coming? And she told me, and I said, hey, Roxy, you better pick another date because Mom's going to be up in Oklahoma to a woman-to-woman. And she said, no, I think I'd like to come down and be with you. And I said, terrific. And she came down. And I'm a father that's plagued with a tremendous amount of guilt. I still want to buy you that tangible thing and give it to you to let you know that I'm sorry. And whenever Roxy and I go shopping, she's very careful not to point because I'm a father that will still try and buy it for her. And we were shopping around North Park that afternoon, and I said to Roxy, I said, hey, I saw in this morning's paper that George Shearing and Mel Torme are playing down at the Fairmont. How would you like to have a night on the town with your dad? And she said, I would just love that. And I remember we made some arrangements for a babysitter, and we got all fancied and gussied up and went down to the Fairmont that night, and the maitre d' took us to the table, and the music began to play, and I said to Roxy, how would you like to dance? And she said, I would just love that. And I remember we were dancing that night, and I was holding my girl, and all of a sudden she said to me, you're just the greatest dad in all the world. You're just the most wonderful person that I know. And, you know, I had waited and worked a lifetime to hear that, and don't you know how grateful I was to the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. The oldest son that got into drugs and sold and jailed and trafficked and so on has had a lot of problems. I can't tell you why. He just had a tough time staying out of jail in a lot of cases. But I'm a father, again, that's so plagued with guilt that I permitted him to stay crippled for almost 12 years. In the first 12 years of my program, whenever he was in trouble, I helped him get out. They called one time from Austin and said he's in jail on 2 counts of criminal mischief, and we paid the attorney, and I didn't have the money, but somehow fathers find the money and mothers find the money when their kids are in trouble. And I remember I sent the money down to the attorney, and it was just a short period of time later they called, and Chuck was in jail again on criminal harassment. And I remember he got on the phone, and the bail was $5,000, and somewhere, I can't tell you why, I just said, Chuck, I don't want to play anymore. I just don't want to play, and it doesn't have anything to do with my love for you. I love you like a rainbow, but I just don't want to play anymore. And I remember I put the phone down, and I wasn't in anger. I wasn't in anything. Marie talked a little bit last night about frozen emotions. I just couldn't think. I put the phone down. God, my heart was broken, and it was hurting, and I didn't know who to call. And I called an Al-Anon, and I said, God, I just said no to my son for the first time in 12 years, and my heart is broken, and I'm going crazy. And she said, well, you got to work the steps. I said, damn it, I know the steps. And she said, yeah, but you're not working them. She said, say out loud that you're powerless over your son, and he makes your life unmanageable. And that morning I said, hey, I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. And somehow it registered. I had intellectualized it so many times, but I had never put it in my heart. And that morning I said, I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. And a power greater than myself is going to restore him to sanity. And I took step 3 out loud. I'm going to turn his will and his life over to the care of God as I understand him. And then she said to me, write down as rapidly as you can those things that make you feel guilty about your son. And I remember the first thing I wrote down was made him do things that he didn't want to do when he was small. I mean, Sally and I wanted him to be a jock and wanted him in athletics and police athletic league and football and baseball and basketball. And if the sun was shining, our foot was in the middle of his back and on the premise that, hey, that's a competitive world out there and one of these days you're really going to thank us. Well, God had gifted him as an artist and a poet and a journalist and a very quiet son. I remember I used to take him and I'd shove him right up against the wall and I'd get those eyeballs to rattle and I'd say, damn it, if you just get your hair cut, if you just get your room picked up, if you just get your grades up, if you just get to school on time, you could be just like me. God, and he used to look out and say, I'll do anything but be like you. I remember one time I had him frozen up there, just pushing him through the wall, and he looked at me so softly, and he said, you're insane. I said, how dare you talk to me like that? I buy the groceries, I pay the rent, I put the clothes on your back. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have what you have. And I didn't know how true that was. Last Father's Day, I got a card from Chuck. Big card. And there was this monkey on the front of it that was dressed up like Humphrey Bogart. And as you open up the card, the caption on the inside was, here's looking at you, Dad. And down on the bottom, it was signed, your son Chuck, P.S. I just want to tell you how proud I am of you and what you've done with your life. You've certainly given me something to live up to." And the middle son, Tom, who just quietly walked away one day, he and I have a couple of business things going together, and I get calls more frequently than I can handle about, "When are we going to get together, Dad, and play some golf?" And then the young son that was forced to go to Louisiana with us had so much hate and anger for Sally and I, he used to keep a loaded shotgun in his bedroom. As a matter of fact, when we first got to Dallas, Texas, when Marie was talking last night about the pillow, some school psychiatrist had recommended that the two of us get locked up in a 10-by-10 room and hit each other with pillows to try and get the anger and the hostility out so we wouldn't kill each other. And I remember standing there that night hitting my son as hard as I could with pillows. And he had to go back to Shreveport and live with a family for 6 months while Sally and I started to get our feet on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. A couple of years ago, John called me and he said, "Dad, could we play some golf and have some lunch?" I said, "Gee, that would be terrific." And afterwards he said, "I need to visit a little bit." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Dad, sometimes I find myself drinking with people that I don't want to drink with. Did that ever happen to you?" And I said, "A couple times." And he said, "Sometimes I find myself in places that I don't want to be. Did that ever happen to you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Dad, sometimes I start out the evening with $200 or $300, and in the morning I only have $10 or $20, and I don't know where the money went. Did that ever happen to you?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "About what? You want me to think that you have a problem? If you do, let me tell you what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to do for you what your mom's dad did for me. I'm going to give you the names of two people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to give you their home phone and their business phones. And if the pain or the confusion in your life gets so bad you can't handle it, you get in touch with them. They got a way out. I'm your father, and I would probably cripple you or kill you. When it says working with others in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, somehow I can look right at your kids and accept it, and I can do what needs to be done. For some reason, I can't look at my own children without a certain amount of expectations. I just can't get it done. I've tried. But I want to tell you something. George and I were talking about this a little before the meeting started this morning. I've come to sleep and to live very comfortably in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing one thing. I'll save your kids, and you save mine. That's the way that's going to work for you and I. Because I want to tell you, as hard as I try, all I can do is hold up the example of how I'm living. The kids hated the personality because they told me they hated the personality. But they've all come back because of the principles. And they found the principles attractive, and they happened to be attached to the personality that at one time they hated. I'm an alcoholic that does not receive very well. I love to give, but I don't receive very well. Maybe one of these days I'll grow a little more in that area. But last Christmas, the kids sent Sally and I an airline ticket, paid in full, to come be with them up in Chicago for the holiday. And I remember when it first got there, I looked at it and I said, "Oh, Sally, I can't take that. I just couldn't. I couldn't make it fit right." And she said, "Isn't it wonderful that they want to be with us?" Because for so many years that they didn't. A little over 5 years ago, I had a heart attack. I was playing some racquetball, and I didn't know it. I didn't have the customary pain that goes with heart attacks. I just had a little nagging pull in my back. And the following morning, I went to work, and I had a business luncheon that day. And that evening, Sally and I went out to dinner, and the pain began to progress just a little more than I would like. And so I said to Sally, "Why don't you take me down to Presbyterian Hospital, and we'll just check it out and see what happens." And we got down there and they started the exam, and all of a sudden this little orderly said, "Well, you're going to feel better with these hoses up your nose and this IV in your arm and this nitro under your tongue." And I had shut down the whole right coronary area, and they took me from the emergency room up to intensive care. And if you've ever been in coronary care units, IC units, they're very rigid and they're very strict, and they have little plaques up there that says family only, 2-minute limit, 2 people only. And Sally and one of the sons had just been there visiting, and I'm kind of wired and going in and out of the oxygen, and I had seen them leave, and all of a sudden I came to, and this beautiful black guy that I sponsor is standing at the end of my bed. And I said to Bob, I said, "Bob, how the hell did you get in here?" He said, "I told him I was family." Ha, 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 ha
said, Dan, what else did you tell him? He said, I told him you were my father. Yeah. It is comical to talk about, but I'm taken by the love and affection that we have for each other. You know, I see on the cups around here, you guys are getting ready to celebrate your 40th anniversary. And a couple of years ago, Sally and I were privileged to be up in Montreal at the International. And I was just fascinated that evening when all of the flags of the various nations came into the stadium. And to think, you know, from two guys, a proctologist and a stockbroker in Akron, we're now over 70,000 registered groups in 114 countries, selling over 3,000 big books a day. That's just incredible to be. Sally's dad, when he first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, used to say to me, I think I will be part of what will be identified as the miracle of the century. And I remember the letter that was written by President Reagan and read up in Montreal where it says, ours is literally a heritage of healing which has changed the face of the earth. And you have to know how grateful I am here this morning to be a part of what I think will go down as the miracle of the century. I had a second heart attack and didn't have any pain with it, and I was told to go to the cardiologist, and I went to the cardiologist, and he said, we're going to have to give you an angiogram because you can't seem to monitor your disease. I said, yeah, I've had that problem once before. And, you know, alcoholics love to negotiate a little bit, and I said, I'd like to talk to the surgeon. And I said to the surgeon, what happens if I don't have the bypass? He said, well, you'll die. And I said, oh, okay, I understand death. And I've said this many times from the podium. I mean, I don't advocate open-heart surgery for an in-depth third step, but I'll tell you this. The night before open-heart surgery, you will take an in-depth third step. And you will have the feeling and the sensation that you're really not running anything. And I want to tell you, between the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, which I so dearly love, you know, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. I love to have the feeling that I can turn me just the way I am over to a power greater than myself. Like all the other speakers that have been here, George and Marie and Sally and Beth and Jack, I wish I could stand up here for a long time and tell you all of the wonderful things that have happened to Sally and myself and the children because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's nice to have a love affair going with your lady after 40 years. You know, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that love is not looking at each other, it's looking in the same direction. Chronologically, we've had a lot of years together, but, you know, we're still learning how to touch and how to feel and how not to be afraid of each other. And I'm very, very grateful that, you know, Sally and I still have meetings. One of the tough things that we had when we first got here was we didn't know how to talk, we didn't know how to communicate, we didn't know how to trust each other, and we were dirty fighters. And so even today, when we need to talk about something, if it's sex or money or children or whatever it is, Sally will say to me, would you like to have a meeting? And that kind of lets me know that we're going to neutralize this thing and we're going to do it under the principles of the fellowship. And she'll say to me, my name is Sally and I'm a very grateful Al-Anon. And then she'll tell me what, you know, she really needs to talk about. And then I'll say to her, my name is Albert and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And every once in a while, I'll interrupt, and she'll remind me that we're in a meeting. And you know, but I pass that along, you know, because it's taken us a long time to find out that each of the children got hurt differently, and we all heal differently. Somehow, I got lost in the fact that I thought if Sally and I would heal, the kids would heal. But one of them had a surface scratch, and the other one had internal bleeding, and they all got hurt a little differently. And so it's been an interesting and exciting journey, you know, to watch the healing process through the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As wonderful as this conference has been, and just been a great day, great 3 days, and to see friends and make new ones and that kind of thing, I still think nothing takes the place of your home group meetings. And I think you and I probably, if there is a responsibility that we have, it's to carry the message from this conference
back to our home group. And I don't know about you, but when I get back to Horizon Monday night, I'm going to tell them that I've been at a place where the blind see and the deaf hear and the lame do walk again, and I'm privileged to be in your presence, and thank you for having me.